Welcome back to Sunday School, everyone. I'm Jared Anderson, and this is Engaging Gospel Doctrine, episode 371.2, which covers the Come Follow Me material for May 31st, and unfortunately and appropriately, I am naming it Us Versus Them. This is Book of Mormon week 20 and covers Mosiah 29 to Alma 4. Before I get into the lesson, I want to talk a bit about why I talk so much about life in this podcast. You know, why not more scriptures? Why not just stick to the scriptures? Well, meaning and application are both found and forged in the spaces between our scriptures and our souls. If scriptures don't change our lives, there is no point to the scriptures. If the gospel doesn't change our lives, there is no point to the gospel. This podcast is about the intersection of the scriptures and our lives. This is what all Sunday school should be like, I think. A primary purpose of the gospel is to increase our stamina in the face of discomfort. I'll say that again. A key purpose of this podcast, of the gospel, of life in general, is to increase our stamina in the face of discomfort. This is a very big reason that I'm doing the podcast. This is why our motto is challenge and be challenged by the scriptures. The gospel makes us grow, and growth is uncomfortable. This is why humans can be described as enemies to God. God invites us to grow, and human nature seduces us to cheat, and most of us work to get away with as much as we can, doing as little as we can. That's just human nature. We have to grow out of it. We have to train ourselves out of it. And this is why I conclude that we are as good as we are incentivized and empowered to be. And a key purpose of this podcast is to motivate, incentivize, and empower you to be a better person. As I've said before, I consider myself a missionary for wellness. That is my primary target. For the outline, I'll have a brief COVID check-in, and this lesson, Us Versus Them, I want to talk about Nephite tribalism and prejudice, what we can learn from a closer look at the Nephites, applying the scriptures to ourselves, and how we deal with racism, tribalism, and bias individually, and how we deal with racism, tribalism, and bias in our communities. And then I'll conclude, because that's basically what this lesson is about. A word about the update. I was already planning on talking about tribalism before George Floyd's murder and the resulting riots, as you can see or hear in my reissued episode. We are dealing with the intersection of racism and the abuse of authority. I work in a prison. I am diligently working to join the military. I have done a training on trauma in law enforcement, which was an amazing, challenging experience. A significant part of this training dealt with moral injury and public misunderstanding. Additionally, living in southern Georgia as a skinny little white boy was one of the most important cultural experiences of my life. The past day or so, I have felt very sad and tired, and it's led me to reflect on the insight that I think the cause of most individual evil is that we get so easily overwhelmed. One of the scariest things about the world today, as I've mentioned before, is that mostly it is systems that are making the decisions, and we as individuals just kind of get bulldozed based on our role in those systems. And this is why when I train prison volunteers, I encourage them to do as much good as the system allows. So on to the COVID update. Trust me, there will be a lot more on that. If we were impeccable about wearing masks, we could pretty much go back to normal and even a better normal. I want to read a Deseret News opinion article by Chantel Sloan, who's an associate professor in the Department of Public Health at Brigham Young University. She writes, I work in infectious disease epidemiology. I'm mostly a number cruncher far removed from the trauma being experienced by families and healthcare providers and hospitals around the world, but I still have an odd kind of front row seat to COVID-19. Watching this scenario unfold has been surreal. It's a tragedy epidemiologists knew was likely in our lifetimes and for which the world was ill-prepared. The personal strain, public division, and politicization has made it all the more difficult to fight and even to understand. Early denials and mistakes in combating COVID-19 outbreaks around the world made the problem worse. That's a fair point of discussion, but it is in many ways immaterial to the methods we need to fight the battle today. Frankly, I'm exhausted. My guess is you are too. It's tempting to want to let the beautiful weather lift the pandemic away like a bad dream. It can seem overblown and far away, especially if you haven't seen suffering patients for yourself. I've certainly thought and felt that at different times. The burden and burnout are real. The economic and emotional tragedy are real. And we all desperately want to be at liberty to move and interact freely. But that's the problem with a pandemic. We can't will it out of our individual lives, not directly at least. We can't pull ourselves up and out of the crisis by our bootstraps because we aren't fighting something that works against just the individual. We are battling a force of nature that attacks by spreading through communities. We might as well try to individually force back an earthquake or a hurricane. All we can do is learn about the virus and do our best to overcome it in a united way. It takes a community to spread the virus, and so it takes a community to stop it. Even a vaccine will be a community-level tool. I remain very hopeful about our ability to overcome COVID-19. I see the path back to our freedom to gather and move without fear becoming clearer. A few months ago, we didn't have the information, materials, or resources to fight or eat on even footing. That is changing. Now we know about how the virus is spread through respiratory droplets. I read this week about simulations suggesting the spread of the virus in classrooms could be kept near zero when at least 90% of students wear cloth masks and sit apart. Isn't that amazing? This is promising. This is so encouraging. In New Zealand, they designated personal bubbles of individuals who could interact freely with each other to counteract loneliness and the burden on people who could not care for themselves. As the disease was eliminated, those bubbles are expanding to include more people. We still have a lot to learn, but our efficacy in the battle is steadily growing. The tricky part is that we can't eliminate COVID-19 by focusing only on our individual liberty. As an aside, I think this is one of the primary problems with dealing with COVID in the US. The tricky part is that we can't eliminate COVID-19 by focusing only on our individual liberty. We have to exercise a kind of generous communal commitment to liberty as a principle. I think members of the church in general are good at that. That was an aside as well. We have to believe in protecting the liberty of another as much as protecting the liberty of ourselves. And that belief has to drive us to make some necessary personal sacrifices. As I move through my community, I see many people wearing masks and many people not. There is an element of discomfort to wearing a mask, and there can be a feeling of loss of personal control or even identity. It is a small change, but it comes at a cost because we are not culturally accustomed to it. The question is, are we willing to pay that cost in order to protect the freedom of one another? If I use my freedom to wear a mask, it does little to protect me from COVID-19. It only protects the people around me. The freedom of vulnerable people to be healthy and move about in society depends on their community generosity, generously choosing to self-sacrifice. Scientists and government do not dictate that fact. The virus does. The idea of generously using our liberty runs against the current tired political talking points, which keep us fighting in trenches against each other instead of together against COVID-19. As another aside, this is why I said COVID-19 is best case World War III, because COVID-19 ideally should be encouraging us to all cooperate together against COVID-19. You are all enlisted, and what you need to do is to wear a mask. It's super, super simple. The mask is your uniform in the battle against COVID-19. I have been wearing a mask whenever I've been around other people. I would love nothing more than to walk through a store and see someone sporting a mask that says, "Don't tread on me," and walk past someone else wearing a mask that says, "The resistance," #the resistance. life and liberty of our neighbor can be put ahead of the other lenses through which we see the world. Isn't that great? I love that. Like, personalize the mask and have it say whatever you want. I have a Star Wars mask that was made by me. Mostly I've just been wearing like the surgical mask, and you can rewear it because it's to stop droplets, not particles. If we want liberty from the pandemic for ourselves, we can only truly get it by making sacrifices to liberate others. We have the tools and knowledge to do so in our communities, regardless of whether there's political will to match. I choose to wear a mask to protect and return your freedoms. Please do choose to protect and return mine. So we are making a tiny, tiny sacrifice of wearing masks in public to protect freedom. And from what she's saying, and from the best that I've seen, if all of us wore masks in public, we could pretty much instantly return or move forward to a new normal. So that's what I hope for. Moving now into the lesson. And again, I have heard that some of you are a bit frustrated about me talking about COVID-19, about me talking, really emphasizing personal application. But I think that is the most responsible way to engage in a Sunday school discussion. So that is what I'm going to model. As a quick guideline, the reissued episodes will focus more on working carefully through the scriptures, and the reissued episodes will focus more on personal application and current events. Because as I said, I think the only way that the scriptures are useful and the only way that the gospel is useful is if it changes our day-to-day lives and if it changes our day-to-day behavior. So I will continue to unapologetically and enthusiastically focus on that. First, Nephite tribalism and prejudice. I'm not currently talking about the 19th century issues around prejudice, racism, and so forth, but I'm talking about what a close reading of the Book of Mormon itself reveals. One of the most impressive things about the Book of Mormon is its complexity, the fact that we can read more closely and question the surface narrative. In fact, this is, I personally think, the greatest compliment we can give to the Book of Mormon is to read it seriously and carefully. So once again, that is something I am trying to model in the podcast. Note how Mormon and the other narrators often assure us about how righteous the leaders are and how great the government is. Then they tell us about defections and rebellions. When Mosiah's sons turn down the kingship, there are certainly other candidates for the monarchy, which is likely what led to the Kingmen, the central conflict for most of the Book of Mormon. Let's dig into the reading. In Mosiah 29, it's interesting that Mosiah shifts from a theocratic monarchy to a democratic-ish theocracy. The chief priest is the chief priest and the chief judge, at least in Alma's case. It makes sense of the text that Mosiah's no king rhetoric functioned to shut down the other claims for kingship, probably from the Mulekites, I'm guessing, based on a close reading. 29:42. It's ironic and not surprising that after Mosiah pushes so hard not to have a king, his close friend Alma becomes a functional king. Alma the Younger is the chief judge plus high priest. In chapter 2 of Alma, we learn that Alma the Younger is also the general. Like, that's wild. Ironically, this shift has centered more power in one individual, not less. Isn't that interesting? Again, close reading, really fascinating stuff. Note how much power remains within the Nephi line through the entirety of the Book of Mormon. As I said, I personally find this close reading approach to be more accurate, rewarding, and powerfully applicable to our own lives. So because it's unfamiliar, it may feel like I'm being cynical, but I'm actually being respectful and earnest by taking the Book of Mormon very, very seriously, serious enough to apply all my training and methodology around biblical interpretation to the Book of Mormon. Alma 1:1, this is full of king language, even though Mosiah just disavowed kingship. And something that I just realized in this work through is that right after Alma is named as high priest and chief judge, we read about a religious threat, then a political threat. Isn't that fascinating? So Mosiah makes Alma the Younger the chief priest and the chief judge. And then we read immediately about religious opposition to Alma as chief priest, and then political opposition to Alma as chief judge. Fascinating stuff, looking for patterns. When we read about Nehor, we can differentiate his philosophy from his actions. And his actions do indeed look selfish and violent. As I commented in my reading notes, Nehor's philosophy seems to be some sort of Christian universalism. And it's worth looking at what he was executed for. It appears that he was executed for heresy more than the murder or duel with Gideon. Again, a close reading, this amusing, you know, they contended warmly with their fists. It does seem to be a cultural dueling paradigm than straight up mob violence or something. Based on the description of the followers' behavior, it seems they followed a form of hedonism, this idea that we need to make the most of this life. And once again, we see evidence of strict laws. We read in Alma 1, verses 24 to 31 about the steadfast faith of the church members. Spoiler, this is going to reverse in just a few chapters. This is worth reading. For the hearts of many were hardened, and their names were blotted out, that they were remembered no more among the people of God, and also many withdrew themselves from among them. Now this was a great trial to those that did stand steadfast in the faith. Nevertheless, they were steadfast and immovable in keeping the commandments of God, and they bore with patience the persecution which was heaped upon them. And when the priests left their labor to impart the word of God unto the people also left their laborers to hear the word of God. And when the priest had imparted unto them the word, they all returned again diligently unto their labors. And the priest, not esteeming himself above his hearers, for the preacher was no better than the hearer, neither was the teacher any better than the learner. And thus they were all equal, and they did all labor, every one according to their strength. And they did impart of their substance, every one according to that which they had, to the poor, the needy, the sick, and the afflicted. And they did not wear costly apparel, yet they were neat and comely. And thus did they establish the affairs of the church. And thus they began to have continual peace again, notwithstanding all their persecutions. This is beautiful stuff. This is a section that provides a template for righteous living. I love it when the scriptures do that. You'll notice that they prosper because they are focused on diligence. They are focused on working. They are focused on giving. They are focused on generosity. They are focused on process, not outcome. And therefore, they are thriving. Now, unfortunately, this thriving sets them up in the pride cycle, and they are going to fall in just a few chapters. So it says, and now because of the steadiness of the church, they began to be exceedingly rich, having abundance of all things whatsoever they stood in need, and abundance of flocks and herds and fatlings of every kind, and also abundance of grain and of gold and of silver and of precious things, and abundance of silk and twine, fine linen, and all manner of good homely cloth. And thus, in their prosperous circumstances, they did not send away any who were naked or that were hungry or that were athirst, or that were sick, or that had not been nourished. And they did not set their hearts upon riches. Therefore, they were liberal to all, both young and old, both bond and free, both male and female, whether out of the church or in the church, having no respect to persons as to those who stood in need. And thus they did prosper and become far more wealthy than those who did not belong to the church. So again, one of the most rewarding things that I have been focusing on in my life is focusing on process, not outcome, diligence, not reward. And this is exactly what the members of the church, I always use small c for the church in the Book of Mormon. I just like read, study, ponder these verses. They are so, so good. Moving now to chapter 2, was Amlici really after the order of Nehor, or is Mormon just putting everyone who disagrees in the bad guy camp? I still think that Amlici being a Mulekite makes the most sense. And this is fascinating. Note that those in power are concerned that the system of voting that they set up, the voice of the people, might not go the way they want. makes you wonder whether the voice of the people were really listened to. Voting doesn't work, so Amlici resorts to violence, and then things escalate. Again, I wonder whether the voting wasn't fair, and that's what led to violence. A core of Jesus' teachings was not to engage in cycles of violence and not to escalate. Note that the Nephites say that the Amlicites plus the Lamanites threaten to wipe them out in 225, but then the Nephites actually do wipe them out and then leave their bodies heaped up upon the earth, which seems to function as a warning. There's some really intense cultural underpinnings here. Alma 3. The beginning of this chapter suggests that both sides were waging a war of annihilation. Read 3:8 through 10. That's the beginning of 3, and then in 3:8 through 10, this is a strong indication of Nephite endogamy, the idea that the Nephites only marry within their people, and possibly even a class system. This is a very interesting conclusion that comes from a close reading of the Book of Mormon, is that at multiple times in the Book of Mormon, the narrator says, oh yes, you know, we were all one and equal and of one heart and we all converted and there were no more Nephites and Lamanites. And then very quickly at key points, they're like, and also this is my genealogy and this is where I come from. And then they divide again into these sub-tribes, which again makes you wonder that, and I think a reasonable conclusion is that the Nephites actually never transcend that tribalism and class system. When I taught world religions and we talked about Hinduism, there was a lot of negative response, of course, to the Hindu caste system. But then I challenged the students and said, so tell me about the US caste system. How does that work? And we'll get to that in just a moment. Alma 4, here's another theme. We wake up most fully when we have no other choice. The people repent, they seek God, they build up the church because so many people were killed in war that it threatened the functioning of society. While I was running with my son today, I was talking about the irony that we are most motivated to survive, but we're not very motivated to thrive. This is my primary motivation. One of my primary motivations in life is that we basically need to be tricked into being our best. In order to survive, when everything's trigger our survival instinct, we work really, really, really hard to survive. But then once we're minimally comfortable, a lot of us stop trying. You know, capitalism and the entire job system is designed to artificially give us anxiety that is usually reserved for when we go hungry. And that's beautiful. And it's not an overstatement to say that civilization as a whole is an artificial structure designed so that our survival instinct can push us into the realm of wellness and thriving. And that's what the gospel is as well. So 4:6-12, the reading comes full circle from those outside the church being prideful and challenging the church to the members of the church becoming prideful and challenging those outside the church. I've included that reading in the reading notes. And this is the context of Alma the Younger giving up his authority and spending his life trying to persuade the people to be righteous. So what can we learn from a closer look at the Nephites? Basically, stay humble and do good. Stay humble. Question and doubt yourself. Doubting your doubts is nice, but we also need to doubt our certainties. We need to listen to others, especially those with different backgrounds and experiences. We need to respect the fact that people are the authority on themselves. This one used to be really hard on me. My primary engagement with life is puzzles. I experience everything as puzzles, which can make me a jerk sometime, although I'm a reformed jerk. And I used to be so obsessed with my own thoughts that I was inconsiderate of other people. And this is why I'm really, really grateful for my life experience, for my training, for some degree of maturity. And so this has enabled me to train humility, openness, respect, and so forth into me. And so whenever I don't understand where someone else is coming from, in fact, just today, I was talking to a friend and he's like, well, I don't understand. I don't understand why this person is doing what they're doing. And I responded, you don't need to. You literally don't need to understand anything. You just need to respect them. And that has really helped me. Help me understand what this is like for you is one of the most important questions I ever ask. Close outsiders have helpful insights. My professional training and experience is in assessing people and then meeting their needs. So I'm very good at it. And yet, we need to take seriously that other people are the only ones who know what it is like to be them. So again, help me understand what this is like for you is a very, very powerful tool. And then we need to help diligently as we can. Applying the scriptures to ourselves. Okay, this is where it gets real, literally. This is where our discussion gets uncomfortable because it needs to get uncomfortable. Let's talk about George Floyd's death. Let's talk about Breonna Taylor. Let's talk about Ahmaud Arbery. Let's educate ourselves on the thousands and thousands of marginalized and murdered. We don't have time to talk about how humans have oppressed, marginalized, enslaved, and exterminated each other for pretty much our entire history. Let me say that again. I'm a historian. Humans have oppressed, marginalized, enslaved, and exterminated each other for pretty much our entire history. In fact, for our entire history. There's a reason why Homo sapiens is the only species of human left. Evidence suggests that Homo sapiens exterminated all of the other hominids that existed, that we as Homo sapiens existed at the same time as the Neanderthals, the Denisovians, Homo erectus, and the other handful of human species, and that sapiens wiped them all out through cooperation. So this is what I describe as original sin. This is our heritage. And the purpose of the gospel is to redeem us from and in that heritage. When I taught world religions, I mean, I had wondered before why some Indians are so much darker than others. The Tamil people, for example, are like black, and then other Indians are lighter. And then I learned about the Aryan invasion of the Indus Valley civilization. And so what happened were the Aryans, I mean, the Aryan race were powerful conquerors. Basically, most of all of Europe and a lot of Asia, including Russia, Iran, all of those peoples are descendants of the Indo-Europeans, and they were a very powerful conquering race, and they were light-skinned. They descended from the Caucasus and from the steppes of what is now southern Russia. And, you know, that's where Caucasian comes from. And so this is one of the roots of modern racism, is this, you know, these conquering Indo-Europeans who conquered and killed all of the other native populations. So I think like Finns, Hungarians, the Basque people, they're these little pockets of Europeans and Asians who aren't Indo-European, but most people are. And the descendants of the Indo-Europeans have been most of, other than like Genghis Khan, have been a large proportion, a disproportionate amount of conquerors, colonialists, and so forth. So the Romans, the Greeks, the Indians, the Celts, the Germans, right? Like it's really, really impressive in a sobering way. There was a sobering summary by Will Smith. I love his summaries. He also said, well, he said, racism isn't getting worse, it's getting filmed. And he is the one who also said, not my fault, my responsibility. And I want you to remember that. I want you to remember this fault, this framing, that it isn't your fault, but it is our responsibility to address the racism and privilege we have in our own lives. Some of you may have seen that meme, "I have privilege as a white person," if you're white, "because I can do all these things without thinking twice." I took the time and effort to look up every single one of these stories, and I'd like to share that with you. Remember, if this is uncomfortable, it should be, and please sit with it. Because as you sit with it with an open, humble heart, you are engaging in an emotional and spiritual workout that will increase your spiritual and emotional stamina. And one of the most important things I have learned from ministry training is that building up your emotional stamina is one of the single most important things you can possibly do. As they say, you know, deal with your own crap so it doesn't get on others. There's transference and countertransference. So the normal thing that happens when someone shares something difficult is that we get uncomfortable. I call this the empathy backfire effect. And then our discomfort becomes our priority. And so we try to discount the tragedy of others to make our mild discomfort better, feel better. Let me state that again. The way we are currently in our culture is that we would rather minimize atrocities than feel mildly uncomfortable. So the first step is to build up your tolerance around feeling mildly uncomfortable. And I hope that it is one thing that I actively try to do in the podcast. It's disturbing that I could type in name plus shooting and be right in almost all instances. I can go birding, Christian Cooper. This is the black man where a woman called the police on him when he asked her to please leash her dog. I can go jogging, Ahmaud Arbery. Ahmaud Arbery was shot and killed by a father and son who had heard about a robbery. I can relax in the comfort of my own home. Botham Jean and Atiana Jefferson. An officer believed she was going into her own home, went into Jean's home and shot and killed him. Neighbors called the police saying Jefferson's door was open and they entered and shot and killed her. I can ask for help after being in a car crash. Jonathan Farrell and Renisha McBride. Farrell crashed his car, knocked on the door. The neighbor called police. The police shot and killed him. McBride knocked on a door asking for help. The homeowner shot her. She was 19 years old. I can have a cell phone. Stephen Clark. Stephen was 23 years old in the backyard of his grandmother's house, and he was shot and killed by officers. I can leave a party and get to safety. Jordan Edwards. Jordan Edwards is a 15-year-old boy in a car. An officer shot him in the head while the car was driving away. I can play loud music. Jordan Davis. A man shot 17-year-old Davis after an argument about loud music. I can sell CDs. Alton Sterling. Two officers shot Sterling after a call relating to CDs. Sterling had a gun but did not draw it. I can sleep. Ayanna Jones. An officer killed a 7-year-old girl during a raid. I can walk from the corner store. Mike Brown. An officer shot 18-year-old Mike Brown while investigating reports of a theft of a box of cigars. I can play Cops and Robbers, Tamir Rice. An officer shot 12-year-old Rice, who was holding a toy gun. I can go to church, the Charleston Nine. A white supremacist killed 9 men and women during their Bible study. I can walk home with Skittles, Trayvon Martin. A member of the neighborhood watch killed 17-year-old Martin, who was visiting relatives. I can hold a hairbrush while leaving my own bachelor party, Sean Bell. Sean Bell was killed right before his wedding. Officers shot 50 rounds into his car. I can party on New Year's, Oscar Grant. Officers killed Grant after a fight that had already been broken up on public transit. I can get a normal traffic ticket, Sandra Bland. Bland was arrested after a routine traffic stop for assaulting a police officer, which means she argued back probably, and she later killed herself in jail. I can lawfully carry a weapon. Philando Castile, this is a particularly tragic one. An officer shot Castile 5 times while Castile was said he was not reaching for the weapon that he declared he had on him. So he was being proactively cautious. I can break down on a public road with car problems, Corey Jones. A plainclothes officer shot Jones while Jones was waiting by his car that had broken down. I can shop at Walmart, John Crawford. An officer shot and killed Crawford, who had a BB gun, in Walmart. I can have a disabled vehicle, Terrence Crutcher. An officer shot and killed Crutcher after a call about an abandoned vehicle. I can read a book in my own car, Keith Scott. An officer shot Scott while looking for someone else. Scott was walking backwards with his hands down, and his wife begged officers not to shoot. I can be a 10-year-old walking with our grandfather, Clifford Glover. An undercover officer shot the 10-year-old boy, believing they were involved in the robbery. Glover and his grandfather ran away because they were scared and didn't know they were police because they were, you know, out of uniform. I can decorate for a party, Claude Reese. An officer shot 14-year-old Reese as he was investigating a possible robbery. I can ask a cop a question, Randy Evans. An officer shot 15-year-old Evans point blank in the head after responding to reports about a youth with a gun. The officer's partner challenged him. The officer was later ruled to be insane and therefore not guilty, but was released within a year. I can cash a check in peace, Yvonne Smallwood. An officer shot Smallwood while she was cashing a check. I can take out my wallet, Amadou Diallo. Plainclothes officers shot at Diallo 42 times after he reached for his wallet. I can run, Walter Scott. An officer pulled Scott over about a brake light and then shot him as he was running away. I can breathe, Eric Garner. An officer put a chokehold on Garner on suspicion of selling single cigarettes. I can live, Freddie Gray. Gray ran away from the officers and they used enough force when they caught him that he died from complications. I can sleep in my own bed, Breonna Taylor. Police broke into Taylor's home looking for someone else and then shot her 8 times in her own home. I can be arrested without the fear of being murdered, George Floyd. The police officer who was kneeling on Floyd's neck was challenged by bystanders and they were told not to interfere. This officer has been charged with 12 times with police brutality and has killed at least 6 other people. What do we do about all this? This made me heavy and exhausted as I was preparing for this, and I hope it makes you heavy and exhausted while you hear about it. How do we talk about this? I hope that this will give us the opportunity and invitation to continue the conversation in a more productive way. Something that I shared on Facebook is that I have privilege as a white person because I feel this heaviness and grief mostly with when another Black brother or Black sister is murdered, after which that grief fades into the background. This grief is not my constant companion. This grief is not a relentless moment-by-moment fear for my own safety and the safety of my children. My friend Lisa pointed out that it's the difference between living with occasional grief and living with constant terror. I started White Fragility yesterday, the book by Robin DiAngelo. She's white, which does matter, and she has made a career of training other white people about whiteness and racism. This should make you uncomfortable. And again, we have to confront and sit with this discomfort. She says about racism, we have to stop thinking about racism simply as someone who says the N-word. This book is centered in the white Western colonial context. And in that context, white people hold institutional power. This means understanding that racism is a system rather than just a slur. It is prejudice plus power. That is a great summary. Racism, institutional racism, is prejudice plus power. And in Britain and the US at least, it is designed to benefit and privilege whiteness by every economic and social measure. Everyone has racial bias, but as DiAngelo is determined to establish, when you back a group's collective bias with lingering authority and institutional control, it is transformed. That is why she is scathing of those who claim reverse racism exists. After all, people of color can show prejudice against white people. It is equally condemnable, but this form of discrimination does not come with systemic privilege, and so is not racism as per the modern definition. So we all are biased and prejudiced, but only those in power can be racist. In more technical language, whiteness scholars define racism as encompassing economic, political, social, and cultural structures, actions, and beliefs that systematize and perpetuate an unequal distribution of privileges, resources, and power among white people and people of color. This unequal distribution benefits whites and disadvantages people of color overall and at the group level. Although individual whites may be against racism, they still benefit from a system that privileges their group. So one reason why I'm doing this podcast the way I am is because I am as anti-racist as I can be. But even though I'm anti-racist, I remain privileged. There is basically nothing I can do about my privilege of being white. Privilege is based on the assumptions and expectations society makes about you. So yes, we are violent. Yes, we kill each other. Domestic violence is one of the highest sources of violence. Yes, police brutality is a problem. But in general, as we look around, violent whites, including mass shooters, are often arrested peacefully. I mean, it's like those white men who are protesting in capitals with automatic weapons, whereas unarmed blacks are being disproportionately killed. So privilege, are you assumed to be dangerous? Are you assumed to be part of the problem or part of the solution? Really quick story. This was a bad morning, but I was driving my kids to school just down the street and I was going too fast. One of my kids was in the front seat. I'm embarrassed by this. One of my kids wasn't wearing a seatbelt and we were in this junky old Yukon and the window wouldn't roll down. And so I was pulled over and the officer could have given me such an expensive ticket. And I got out of my car and the officer said, okay, you know, sir, don't get out of your car. Not everyone is as nice as you. And I immediately corrected in my head, not everyone is as white as you. And so again, are we assumed to be innocent or are we assumed to be dangerous? My favorite definition of privilege is the things you have the luxury of not worrying about and the degree to which the system makes you work for equal or lesser outcomes. So yes, it's possible for marginalized populations to become tremendously successful. Oprah is one of the richest people in the world, but she is still treated as black. There was that story where she was trying to buy a handbag. And I don't think there should even exist handbags that cost tens of thousands of dollars. But the store owner assumed that she couldn't afford a handbag because she was black. So that's how racism and privilege work. How do we deal with racism, tribalism, and bias individually? We have to name it. We have to listen. We have to keep ourselves educated. We have to educate ourselves as much as we can and to keep all of this in mind as we move through life. I love that my sister posted this by Courtney Ariel, who's a black singer and storyteller. So what do we do? How do we become allies in this racist system? So allies to the marginalized. I am not going to do much coddling here. I don't know that I believe that love requires coddling. Here are six things you can do to be stronger allies. One, listen more, talk less. You don't have to have something to say all of the time. You don't have to post something on social media that points to how liberal, how aware, how cool, how good you are. You are lovely, human, and amazing. You have also had the microphone for most of the time, for a very long time, and it will be good to give the microphone to someone else who is living a different experience than your own. One of the biggest things that I want in my podcasting is to have a co-host or to have guests with different perspectives. That is something I worked on very diligently when I did have the luxury of having guests. And so what I try to do as a privileged, middle-aged, white, cisgender, straight man is, and a lot of those are squishy, you know, is that I try to use my privilege and pass to do as much good as I can. And so that's what I'm trying to do in this podcast. But I take these seriously and I want to do better. Two, for one out of every three opinions or insights shared by a person of color in your life, try to resist the need to respond with a better or different insight about something that you read or listened to as it relates to their shared opinion. Try to just listen and sit with someone else's experience. This is really great ministering advice in general. Try to just listen and sit with someone else's experience. This is why hospice has done me so much good, because my job has been to sit with people's experiences. When you do share in response to what someone has shared with you, it can sometimes not always feel like white-splaining, meaning to explain or comment on something in an overconfident or condescending way. This adds to the silencing of the voices of people of color. Three, being an ally is different than simply wanting not to be racist. Thank you for that, by the way. Being an ally requires you to educate yourself about systemic racism in this country. Again, this is what I'm trying to do with this episode of this podcast right now. Read Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow and Ta-Nehisi Coates' Between the World and Me, that's next on my list, and Claudia Rankine's Citizen and so many other great books and articles that illuminate oppression and structures of white supremacy and white privilege. Use your voice and influence to direct the folks that walk alongside you in real life or follow you on the internet toward the voice of someone that is living a marginalized or disenfranchised experience. Four, please try not to, I can't believe that something like this would happen in this day and age, your way into being an ally when atrocities like the events in Charleston, South Carolina, and Charlottesville, Virginia happen. People of color have been aware of this kind of hatred and violence in America for centuries, and it belittles our experience for you to show up 300 years late to the oppression party suddenly caring about the world. Don't get me wrong, I welcome you. I want for you to come into this place of awareness. However, your shock and outrage at the existence of racism in America echoes the fact that you have lived an entire life with the luxury of indifference about the lives of marginalized and disenfranchised folks. Please take several seats. Five, ask when you don't know, but do the work first. This is nuanced. Some marginalized and disenfranchised folks will tell you not to ask them anything. Don't be offended by that. Folks are tired, and that is understandable because it is exhausting to be a marginalized person in this world. However, there is something special that happens within human connections and relationships. In a nutshell, don't expect for people to educate you. Google it yourself, you know? Do the work to educate yourself. Ask questions within relationships that feel safe and do so respectfully. Six, and finally, stop talking about colorblindness. It's not a thing. I've shared that my youngest, Miriam, will always say that. That's not a thing. I love it so much. Colorblindness is totally impossible in a nation whose land was taken from the indigenous inhabitants through an attempt at genocide and horrific colonialization. The same nation that enslaved humans and exploited them in every imaginable way built a nation on their backs, hung them, hunted them, and for centuries kept them from their basic inalienable rights, and still does. The same nation that exploits and deports immigrants who are promised refuge within the American Constitution. The same nation that incarcerated Japanese Americans during World War II and continues to promote bigotry, exclusion, and violence against LGBTQ gender non-identifying folks. This nation that allows swastika-wearing, Confederate flag-toting, anti-Semitic racists to have a platform for their hate. The same nation that promised religious freedom yet targets those who do not believe in a white capitalist Jesus. I love Jesus, and I promise Jesus was not white, literally brown and wonderfully Jewish, and would never have been capitalist. It will never be possible for us to be colorblind, and we shouldn't want to be. I heard a saying once at an Al-Anon meeting that offered me liberation. We are only as sick as our secrets and our shame. Shame can only live in the darkness. It can live within the systems of denial and defensiveness that we use to cover it up. We have to name these things, acknowledge them, and begin to do the deep work of transformation, restoration, and reparation. Yep, now I'm talking about reparations. Privilege means that you owe a debt. You were born with it. You didn't ask for it. And you didn't pay for it either. No one is blaming you for having it. You are lovely, human, and amazing. Being a citizen of a society requires work from everyone within that society. It is up to you whether you choose to acknowledge the work that is yours to do. It is up to you whether you choose to pay this debt and how you choose to do so. Sometimes living with privilege can disillusion us into thinking that being in community with other humans doesn't require work. This is a lie. It requires a great deal of work. And all of that work requires being a human and trying to love other humans well. That is my religion. I love it. Being a human and love other humans well. Live well. That's the core of my religion and, you know, my interpretation of the gospel. I believe this is a holy work, the work of justice, the pursuit of it. It doesn't need an audience and it will not always have one. It will happen most days in ways that are unseen. It might mean providing a meal or shelter, listening, using your particular area of expertise to help someone in need of that expertise who might not have access to it otherwise, bailing a protester out of jail or paying a family's rent for 1 month if you have the resources to do so, or marching at a rally with marginalized folks alongside other allies. There may not always be a practical, tangible way to pursue this work, but I believe you will know it when you meet it face to face. However it looks, it will be something that you do without needing to be thanked or receive praise. You are not a savior. Marginalized, disenfranchised folks can and will survive without you. We are magic. However, I urge you to pursue this work knowing that a system of white privilege afforded you access to opportunities while denying them to so many others. Above all, I urge you to keep trying. You're going to make mistakes, expect this, but keep showing up. Be compassionate. Lead with empathy always. Keep learning and growing. If you do this, I truly believe you'll be doing the work of an ally. If you're still here, if you're still listening, thank you. We need this endurance. We need to listen. We need to internalize these principles. I personally feel motivated to get as much privilege and, yes, power as possible so that I can use it to do good. So I can use it with humility and deference, so that I can incorporate as many checks and balances as possible. But I want to do as much good and to do as much good as I possibly can. And that means to drive the vehicle of my whiteness and privilege and pass, again, to serve as much as I can. I want to say a quick note about police brutality. As I said, I am very sympathetic and supportive of law enforcement officers. Law enforcement, military, emergency management, these are areas of life that are dear to me. These cultures also create a very tight-knit and supportive connections, more like family than coworkers, which is often highlighted. You know, you are my brother, brothers in blue, thin blue line, and so forth, which makes holding each other accountable and disciplining members very difficult. I've been binging 911 and really enjoying it. So it's not paradoxical, it's very, very predictable, but the very cohesiveness that law enforcement, military, emergency management need, and yes, I'm wearing Black Panther cufflinks, the very cohesiveness and support that members of these very, very difficult life and death careers, it becomes an identity. And so they need that support. It also makes it very difficult to hold each other accountable in those communities. As I've shared, I feel driven to join the military as a chaplain, and I want to do what I can to help these issues. I also want to volunteer. I mean, I work in law enforcement. I'm a prison chaplain. And I want to do what I can to volunteer in law enforcement contexts as well. So how do we deal with racism and tribalism and bias in our communities? improving policies is the only way. We need to actually invest in opportunities that empower the marginalized to succeed. We need to elect more diversity into our leadership. I was so devastated that the presidential race diminished from an admirable range of diversity to yet another white men. I want to say a word about the riots. One point I wanted to make is that I think there are two main things going on right now: protests and opportunism, often by different people. It is tragic and infuriating and utterly predictable that as the marginalized and oppressed and murdered groups fight for attention and justice, the privileged once again take advantage of the chaos. Again, to wrap up, if you're still with me, thank you. Thank you so much for listening to this challenging conversation. It's been challenging to produce it, but I'm very committed. I don't need any badges, you know, for that. I'm committed to doing this because it's the right thing to do. I'm committed to using my voice the best way that I can, to use my gifts the best way that I can. So again, thank you for listening to the podcast. And I hope that you can see the connection between these Book of Mormon chapters of us, them, violence, war, prejudice, pride, oppression, and the way that it lines up with our current situation in the world right now. In conclusion, I don't think we are ever going to overcome prejudice, bias, tribalism. My passion is the intersection of human nature and religion. Until the robots or aliens reprogram our brains, we are not going to overcome prejudice, bias, tribalism. And this is why I advocate an approach that I call redeemed realism. I believe that the best way to compensate for and engage these very, very powerful cultural, socialized, systemic, how many big words can I use? These ideas are pervasive, insidious, and bigger than us. And so I am convinced the only way to address them is to say, I am hopelessly biased. I am hopelessly prejudiced. I am hopelessly not technically hopelessly, but inevitably. Inevitably is a better word. I am inevitably biased, prejudiced, privileged, wherever we fall on that continuum. And therefore, I am going to be honest about that. I'm going to be humble about that. And I'm going to take that into account as I move forward in my life. And so I think the greatest and initial hope is to have a humble awareness of bias, a humble awareness of privilege. And I think the best thing for us to aim for is collaborative tribalism, where we as gently as possible love and care for our in-group and then reach across the boundaries of those in-groups and become allies in our respective tribes and groups. And I think that as we do this, we can work toward Zion and work toward the oneness that the scriptures teach. So again, thank you for joining me for another episode of Engaging Gospel Doctrine. Thank you for all that you're doing to make the world a better place, which starts with being better, loving better. Thank you so much for those who support the podcast and keep it free for everyone else.